The high school I went to started off as the only black high school in the city where I grew up, until whites were integrated into it. When a system of busing was alive and well within my city, my high school was one of the best to be at. I, a middle-class white kid from the suburbs, was a minority in this school. My school was also part of the ESL program, or English as a Second Language. There are certain buildings and hallways you'd walk down that didn't even sound like you were in the United States anymore. For most part, these different races and socioeconomic groups all got along. We all had pride of our high school. This isn't always the case. There are many different areas in our world that different races and classes, they don't get along. And today we are exploring the different societies and classes within the show Game of Thrones and in the pages of the Bible. We hope you subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you're listening to us on. Please leave us a rating and review so the algorithms that run the world will know you are enjoying our conversations. Please share with your friends and help get the word out too. You can continue these conversations on our Facebook page, facebook.com/theologyof, or if you have any questions or comments, you can email us at theologyof@gmail.com. I am Jim Parsons, and with me is Wes Smith. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Theology Of, a podcast about seeing God in the ordinary. So the kind of the map of this land known as, you know, in the Game of Thrones, it's kind of broken up into, well, there's like, I think, three continents, or four continents officially, but really the two big ones that are discussed in the HBO show are Essos and Westeros. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the societies and civilizations we see in Essos, and then Wes is going to talk about Westeros itself and the kingdoms and the situation over there. I think one of the I thought it was always a cool kind of society or group, or really they're probably more of a tribe, is the Dothraki. I mean, we get to introduce to them, I think, in the first episode, if not really soon into episode, or in the first season. And they're the Targaryens are there trying to sell off, well, not sell off, but marry into this army, basically. And what's interesting is they are ruled as with a as a king, but they don't call it a king. It is a call. And they also have a very high, almost worshipful interaction with horses as well. You know, when if a call dies, they automatically kill their horse right then and there, so that they can enter into the next realm together, which is kind of neat. But they're a nomadic tribe. They've taken up the middle of Essos, and it seems that as the lore goes, that they were all the way out to the east, and then they came over the Mountain of Bones, and kind of in the grasslands set up camp and really laid waste to a lot of the kingdoms in that area, and kind of took it over. And the grasslands were then referred to as the Dothraki Sea. But the call takes a queen, a Khaleesi, and in the show, Daenerys is the Khaleesi to Khal Drogo. And that's kind of how her story starts. But it's interesting to look at kind of how that tribal community, that nomadic tribe of people, really follow her for the rest of the show, and, you know, out of a sense of duty and honor to her as kind of their Khaleesi or queen. But it's interesting, you know, there's a scene right before Daenerys just lights the whole thing on fire. But the tribe coming together after Khal Drogo dies, and they're trying to figure out what to do next. So it's kind of you have a king or a call, but then a kind of a board or group, or trying to figure out what the better word would be. But kind
council.
Of a council. Thank you, a council of elders that comes together to decide who's going to be the next call. So it's you can see some similarities to real world kind of communities and cultures at the time. You know, you think of Genghis Khan and kind of his conquest of Eastern Europe and I guess it'd be Western Asia. You know, it kind of has a similar feel to it. Mongolians with their love of horses as well, and kind of being nomadic tribesmen over there too. You kind of have a sense of that, sense of that too.
Yep.
But real, I mean, some really cool. I don't know. Khal Drogo is just a great character.
Yeah.
And to see him interact with Daenerys, but also her brother. I forget how to say his name.
Is it Viserys?
Viserys, that's it. I mean, probably my, one of my top death scenes would be when Viserys gets the gold poured on top of his head.
Oh yeah, that's terrific.
And you're kind of like, yay, what a jerk.
Yeah.
But I mean, the community there, just their loyalty to whoever is the ruling person is dramatic, and they that whole community and or culture, you know, follows all the way through the end because they're there with their whatever you want to call their swords that are bent and kind of a you know, their unique swords are all lit on fire as they go fight the White Walkers in the last season. So
yeah.
It's a different set of community because especially as we head to Westeros, you see more of a they're not nomadic over there, but here you got a moving population of people that are known as fierce warriors, very down to earth. They, you know, live with horses and kind of have a bond between the earth and them and the creatures they use constantly.
Right, and we'll get into some of the kind of sociological, cultural issues in a couple episodes. Looking at the difference between Essos and Westeros, you know, Westeros is really kind of it's system of houses, like great houses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look up a list of houses in Game of Thrones, and it's like really huge, especially if you're going by the books. But at the time, the storyline of the series is taking place, there are 9 kind of great or noble houses. I'm not going to list them all. It's just, you know, of course, Starks and Lannisters, Baratheon, and then the Targaryens, and there obviously are, several more. Mm-hmm. And it really is, kind of the way Westeros is structured. It really is kind of like, England. In the probably what we would call the Middle Ages, like or maybe High Middle Ages, I guess. I don't know. I'm not a historian.
Right.
But kind of the Middle Ages, right at the cusp of the Enlightenment, right at the cusp of a whole lot of change in European history. And the show kind of acknowledges. You can tell just by watching the show and some of the things that they say. The show acknowledges the existence of kind of a they let you know what the political system is. It's a feudal, right. Feudal system, and there's some kind of economic system, but that's not really a focus. You know, I think kind of they're trying to avoid, you know, the Phantom Menace problem of, you know, yeah, we waited all those years for Star Wars and what we got were, you know, trade disputes. Right. So, you know, you don't want to. So a lot of that information is just either visual cues, you know, those people are poor, or, you know, discussions like with the Iron Bank and kind of things like Cersei's attitude toward the citizens of King's Landing,
mm-hmm.
For example, where she's like, basically, I don't care if they all die.
Right.
And, you know, Tyrion at one point says, you know, what kind of queen will you be if all your subjects are dead?
Mm-hmm.
And Cersei's like, you know, I don't care if they're all dead. My job's easier.
Right.
Yeah. Basically.
Let them eat cake.
Let them eat cake. And you know, part of this too is stuff they never explore really, or you know, they kind of set it up but don't really go into detail because they don't have to. It's a story. They don't have to solve real world problems. But you know, the series is kind of a window of time into like just a series of protracted wars.
Hmm.
Which really corresponds to European history. And with these long wars lasting decades, what you have is a refugee crisis, a migrant crisis, because people are trying to leave wherever there's warfare. They're trying to leave. You know, anytime you a village or town is sacked, those people have to go somewhere. And so that's kind of in the background of the series. The poor are by and large invisible in the show. They're called small folk.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about this topic about class and society and how things are structured, you know, the show really kind of mirrors how we deal with politics in our own day, where it's like a personality contest, like, or a popularity contest or cults of personality. Like, we're so focused on these rulers, these individual personalities like Ned Stark or Joffrey or Jon Snow or Daenerys Targaryen and Cersei. Like, we lose sight, or you can lose sight of the fact that a decision Cersei makes on a whim might kill 100,000 people.
Right.
Yeah, but that's, you know, we can get caught up in that same kind of tabloid, you know, stuff with our own politics. And certainly that's the case when we study history. We look at these great kings and queens and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, we don't pay much attention to the ordinary people, you know, the farmers and the, you know, the foot soldiers and all that kind of stuff. So, but if they were to focus on the small folk, it would be a very different show.
It would. I mean, we get a taste of that, you know, when Arya's in the, Temple of the Man with No Face, or, when she's getting trained to be an assassin.
The Faceless God.
Yes, Faceless God. Thank you. You know, that we kind of see the normal small folk, I guess you could say, because she's hanging out with them.
Yeah.
But it's not a big character. We're going to follow the big characters, and the story is all about kings and lords and who's going to be sitting on the throne at the end of it.
Yeah, obviously they're there. Like the small folk, you know, there's the storyline with, we talked about a little bit in our last episode about the Hound with the poor farmer and his daughter. So they're obviously a presence, and the Brotherhood Without Banners is kind of a revolutionary impulse. You know, there's this kind of thread running through about, you know, trying to bring down tyrants. And of course, Daenerys' storyline in Essos is, you know, freeing the slave, you know, flipping over the, you know, kind of social order. But it's not, there are no like extended monologues, which is refreshing to me.
Yeah.
Like they're not handing us social commentary. You know, not feeding us that with a spoon. You know, you kind of have to, there are lines here and there throughout the show that kind of talk about it, but Tyrion's not doing what he's doing for the common man. You know,
it's no.
Not, there's really no populism in Game of Thrones.
No.
Which really reflects kind of the feudal, the period of history, the feudal society of England at the time. And, you know, it pretty well known among fans of the show that a lot of the storyline is based on the War of the Roses from English history, which happened the second half of the 15th century, the battle between the Lancasters and the Yorks. So it's not that far, Lannisters and Starks. You know, that's not that far.
Right.
And, you know, just a lot of bloodshed, a lot of violence. I saw actually an article written by Caroline Sue. I can't remember the website. Maybe Investopedia might be the website. But she wrote an article about that, about economics in Game of Thrones. She said, you know, historians say the bloody power struggle of the War of the Roses eroded the power of the feudal lords, strengthened the monarchy, and paved the way for the rise of capitalism a few centuries later. So that kind of transition where the feudal model fell apart gave rise to what I believe it was Sam at the end was kind of wanting things to tilt towards democracy.
Well, he offers it up at the end.
Yeah, he says, what about... You know, what about everybody gets a vote and everybody's like, ha, the small folk?
Right.
You know, you know, culture's not there yet.
Right.
But, you know, what you see in Game of Thrones, like if you're poor in Westeros, you stay poor.
Right.
Like if you don't belong to one of the great houses, you know, you're just, you know, you are who you are.
Mm.
And that's where, you know, there's no way to climb the ladder, really.
Right. Well, I mean, Sam would actually be a good example of that. I mean, he does climb the ladder a little bit.
I mean, well, he came from not one of the gray houses, but he came from, you know, his dad was the Tarleys were pretty prominent. I can't remember who they were aligned with, what gray house, but, you know, his family were not, you know, his dad had a keep.
Right.
So he came from a prominent family.
Right. But I'm saying, like, you couldn't, there wasn't a, somebody who kind of went through his scope of things, going to the wall, becoming a member of the Night's Watch, and then all of a sudden rising up.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't, you don't, that would have been the exception.
Right. But that doesn't even happen with even, you know, some of the B characters like Sam. They come from a big house, and, you know, then they're in the end have a seat at the council to make decisions. You don't have a normal person who, you know, was raising crops and then somehow became better.
Yeah, this is not a meritocracy.
No.
You know, if, and really, judging by the show, I mean, there's no science to speak of. You know, medicine, you know, I mean, it really is 15th century England.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not, you know, if you want to be a scholar, you become a maester. So there seems to be like, there didn't seem to be any kind of, governmental attention to like infrastructure and schools and
right
stuff like that. So it's just like, it's like really underdeveloped. So in that way, it's even less developed than 15th century, England. Mm. Because in 15th century England, you had like universities and, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know the specifics of like, could a, you know, a vassal go to university? I don't know that kind of stuff, but, and again, you're not going to get that level. I mean, it's a very detailed world in Game of Thrones, but there are some things that just are not pertinent to what's happening in the show.
Right. They exist, but it's not given much attention because it's just the world that these characters are in.
Yeah, exactly. So,
although my mind, as we were talking, did go to one character that did kind of start off as nothing and kind of move up, and that's Grey Worm.
Oh, that's true.
You know, he's a, for those who don't remember, he is part of the Unsullied, and as Daenerys kind of comes in and frees the free cities in Slaver's Bay, or the slaves within the cities around Slaver's Bay, she comes and purchases the Unsullied, and then gives the command to kill all the masters, and
right.
Says, you know, you'll fight for me, or tells the Unsullied that these eunuchs who have been trained since, you know, birth to fight and to relinquish pain and just be unwavering loyalty, but she frees them and says, but now as free men, will you fight with me? And they do, and they choose a leader out of this slave, basically the slave army, and that's who they choose is Grey Worm, who then does follow on and kind of is in the seats of power later on in the show.
Right. Well, and as you're talking about that, I'm thinking too, like, I think I made a more declarative statement than I wanted to make about not being able to rise to the top, because then, you know, you got one of my favorite characters, Ser Davos. At the beginning of the show was basically a smuggler and illiterate, and
right.
I mean, by the end of the show, he is he's pretty prominent.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it could happen, but there wasn't a pathway for it. You know, it wasn't like if I work really hard, I know like I can make my way up. It really, a lot of that was the luck of relationships.
Yeah, it's who you're following. I mean, Grey Worm would have just been another soldier cast, you know, into battle, and if dies, no one thinks anything of it until he was chosen as a leader.
Yes.
It doesn't have the American pick yourself up by the bootstraps feel at all.
As I'm thinking about, like, in terms of like this kind of grand storytelling, like this is kind of a saga or an epic kind of thing. Like, the point of Game of Thrones is not to make the point of the show is not to critique class.
Right.
Or to have a certain critique of economic systems. That's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you're getting kind of taken away from that when it comes to class or social structure, it's kind of a second order kind of thing where, you know, there's a narrative choice or a scene or a line or some kind of plot point that you can kind of say, okay, well, obviously this is to drive the narrative. But if this were happening in the real world, here's the economic and social consequences of that or whatever. Game of Thrones is not kind of blatantly socially conscious.
Right.
And it's not pretending to be.
No.
So, I think, but as a, and one of the things I'm interested, I was interested in as I was kind of doing, the research for this episode is like, what are the, like, if there are kind of like secondary or ancillary, social critiques to draw out of this show, how does it sync up with our time?
Mm-hmm.
And I drew a blank. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, maybe I'm supposed to have something more eloquent there, but, I mean, it, you know, there are all kinds of lessons about personal, like personal greed or.
Yeah.
Power, that kind of stuff. But in terms of like how government should be structured, I think the lesson is like, don't do it like they did it.
Right. You could stretch that for individuals, and look for meaning there, but you're right. This is not a commentary on like, you know, the socioeconomic status of the United States and its relations to China or something like that. That's not what the point of it is.
Yeah. I think you're more apt to learn maybe about history. Now, at some point, we'll talk about the High Sparrow.
Yes. Kind of that's next week.
That's next week, yeah. Which I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
I mean, there is, you know, you can say there's some social commentary there, but in terms of economics, I mean, you got stuff like the Iron Bank, which is, I mean, it's the economic stuff. I read an article, I didn't sink in because I don't remember who wrote it or where I found it. They're kind of saying basically the economic system of Westeros is pretty muddled.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's not a whole lot of, it's just not like they didn't pay much attention to if that would work in the real world or not, or what that would look like, which is okay with me. That's fine.
Right.
But then again, I imagine if you're in a feudal society, economics and are going to be pretty muddled anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they're not going to be worrying about serfs and what they, you know, what kind of life do they have compared to the lords and dukes or,
yeah,
whatever the system is.
Now,
good.
Real quick, I did see a really cool infographic online, and we can post this on our Facebook page from the website winterscoming.net. They have like an infographic of the economy of Westeros, which will probably expose me to be somewhat of a fraud by saying it wasn't organized, because it's a very organized infographic. And it kind of shows you, based on what we see, I think, in the books and the show, kind of how the economy would have functioned.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll post that on our Facebook page.
Yeah. But I mean, but the economy back in, you know, feudal Europe was probably very similar. Things ebbed and flowed with who was in charge and who was, you know, who was winning the wars or who took over what. And
if, you know, if it's feudal and a lot of that, you know, a lot of that's, you know, there's obviously currency, but there's also a lot of bartering. You know, a lot of that economy would have been local.
Mm-hmm.
But then what you, with the kind of the rise of mercantilism and then eventually colonialism, you see a big increase in trade and, you know, kind of the economies, you know, the complexity of the economy begins to grow, leading to the rise of capitalism. Now, I'm sure we're going to have listeners that are far more knowledgeable about the kind of the history of economics than I am, because I know like nothing.
Right. I'm about right economics. There with you. Not my area of expertise.
But I'm willing to make stuff up.
Just so it sounds good.
Just so I sound smart, even though I'm not about this stuff.
Right. Well, and to go back to kind of like that kind of structure and power, we see this a lot in the show itself too, is who is marrying who. You know, can these houses come together through marriage to then build a stronger bond? I mean, that's why Starks are, you know, offering up, you know, their daughter to marry the king, or the soon to be king, Lannister, Joffrey. So, you know, those things existed back then of, you know, marrying a French prince with an English prince so they could be together and have a stronger, you know, force or kingdom together.
Right. So the kind of the arranged marriage idea and, you know, that marriage as kind of a political partnership and economic kind of, what's the word we're looking for? Transaction.
Yeah. Which is why we find, I can never remember his name, Viserys, you know, passing off his sister, Daenerys, to Khal Drogo. So right. that he can, you know, build this army or have this army to then go take back the Iron Throne. So, you know, that's what they're looking for, marriage and passing off, you know, in a very masculine world, passing off women to then marry into families so that the men can have more power.
Yes.
Which is interesting because in the very end, you have Sansa who wants the North to be free and she's going to rule or be up there, you know, to break them off as a completely independent kingdom from the rest of the Westeros.
Yeah, and I think as you look at the show as a whole and that kind of movement, to me, kind of the last season, and more kind of really more so in that last episode, but as I'm thinking about it, you can take it all the way back to the Wildlings, people north of the Wall, that we're beginning to see seeds of revolution. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think Sansa kind of represents, and this is what was, I think it was so jarring watching that episode when Sansa just said, you know, we're going to be independent. Nobody batted an eye.
No, they didn't.
You know, nobody was like, you know, in like real world history, that, you know, a ruler says that, that's the start of a war.
Right.
You know, that's basically, you know, that's kind of like secession. I mean, it was really, my sense of Westeros is always kind of a loose confederacy, or, you know, the king kind of had loosely held power mm-hmm. over Westeros, but Sansa just said, look, we're out of here. Everybody's like, all right, cool. See ya.
Right.
And like, there was no conflict there. I mean, granted, they had like, you know, 10 minutes left of the series.
Right. They're not going to spare a lot of dialogue on that aspect of it.
Yeah, but that you know, obviously you're tying up loose ends, but that I have to imagine if the storyline were to have continued, that would have led to a war. Or at least a cold war.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and maybe not between Sansa and Bran, but, you know, there are going to be some folks who are not, you know, if the North can go, why can't we?
Right. Yeah.
So that's but then again, you know, the storyline, you got to end the storyline somewhere. You know, Game of Thrones is not real life. It's not just going to continue on. So.
Right. And I mean, if you're looking at the geography, the North is almost cut off. You know, there's a distinct difference between, you know, below, what is it, the neck, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Kind of like this tighter, smaller, narrower part of the island, down into the other kingdoms, but then the North is kind of shut off. So, I mean, it'd have been interesting if that conversation had some legs and, continued to go on, or, you know,
yeah, they could have been like, bones. You know, judging by the way Daenerys reacted to the Northerners when, you know, she went up to Winterfell, they could have been like, all right, good, we're finally, you know, we don't have to deal with these people anymore.
Right.
And so who knows? I don't know.
All right, so what are some areas where we see society and class depicted in Scripture?
All over the place.
I don't think you can open up a page and drop your finger on something, and you're always going to hit something that's going to be a commentary literally on society and class.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, you know, you don't want to zero in on economics, but so much of that, especially in terms of class. And what I really love about Scripture is there's, you know, the broad sweep of, you know, you start in the Old Testament with, you know, kind of Genesis with the nomadic tribes, basically. And then, of course, Egypt, you get an introduction to empire and slavery.
Right.
And then you see in the Torah and the Hebrew law, a lot of attention is paid to kind of a big part of the law is how to structure this society.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just kind of, it's kind of taken for granted that there are going to be wealthy people and poor people.
Right.
Like we're not given a, like there's no, Hebrew society, Israelite society was not a utopian society. You know, there were going to be, it, you know, it was strata, you know, there was stratification here. You're going to have upper class and lower class, and that was kind of taken for granted. Mm-hmm. Until we get to the year of the Jubilee.
Which is an interesting concept. Can you inform people about who may not know what the year of the Jubilee is?
I could try. I've talked about it before in Bible studies and things like that, and I still have a hard time wrapping my mind around the specifics of the year of Jubilee. But the basic idea, I think, is every 50 years, right, the 50th year?
I think, yeah.
Okay, so every 50th year, there's like basically a social and economic reset.
Mm-hmm.
Like every 50 years, slaves are freed. And property, all property is returned back to the original family that owned it.
Right.
If memory serves. And all debts are basically canceled. And so basically like every 50 years, we go back to square one.
Right.
Which you read some interesting, like I've read some interesting Old Testament scholars who were kind of questioning, was the year of Jubilee actually ever even tried?
I was just thinking that. I was like, I'm trying to wrap my brain, you know, do we hear any of the kings going, hey, it's a year of Jubilee? Or, you know, is it actually ever happened?
My hunch is that it didn't really happen. And actually, there's a big connection between kind of Jesus' vision of the kingdom of God. That sounds like kind of a universal Jubilee.
Mm-hmm.
Setting everything to equal.
Right.
And really in the Old Testament, it's not very prominent. Like it's in the law, but you know, it's not a major theme, put it that way.
Right.
But as you go through the Old Testament, you know, the Hebrew people come out of Egypt, out of slavery, and they're kind of continue this nomadic lifestyle until they settle in the promised land.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's basically, it's kind of like it begins to be an agricultural economy.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of settle. And then, you know, there's trade and war and all that kind of stuff. Then out of that comes the monarchy. And that's when things politically get really complicated. And I think the monarchy is kind of what that really kind of solidifies the ideas of class, and you know, things get a lot more kind of organized and rigid.
Right. Well, you see a movement too, where, you know, the Hebrew people, the Israelites, they were wanting to be more like the people around them.
Yes.
And I mean, so God's idea of setting up a different society was that this chosen people would be different than the rest of the world. And people would look at them going, hey, I want what they have. I want to be like they are. You know, the light into the and light on top of the hill to you know, show the world what it's supposed to be like. But
and one of those differences, like a major difference, is the intention of how they were to treat the poor among them,
right?
And how they were to treat immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So that was to be like to set them apart. And what's the refrain you see over and over again in the Old Testament is, you know, treat the poor. Provide for their needs, treat the stranger or the immigrant or the alien, treat them like one of your own when they're in their land. Do not mistreat them. I am the Lord your God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like their identity as a people is built on God. And that's kind of the reason that they're to do these things, because it's a reflection of the God they belong to, so to speak.
Right.
And, you know, the God of the Hebrew people and the God of Scripture loves the underdog.
Right.
And so that is the thing that shows up again and again. And, you know, it's a theme in the prophets about taking Israel to task for mistreatment of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a refrain again and again throughout the prophets, that God will judge them for how they mistreated the poor.
Yeah. And you see that moving on, you know, following into Jesus's gospels, you see that as well. I mean, how many parables does Jesus say where he picks the person that you're not thinking of? Like you think of the Good Samaritan, you know, he's not looking for a Samaritan, which is a hated person for Jews. to be the hero of the story. And so he's kind of turned society on his head there. You know, he's always picking the widow who or the tax collector who's praying compared to the Pharisee. He's choosing the sinner, the tax collector, over the Pharisee. And so when Jesus comes in, he's taking that society that's kind of gotten a long, you know, centuries worth of roots growing and kind of flipping it on its head, going, this is not exactly how God was having this planned.
Right.
You know, the Pharisees and the religious leaders of the day, they had added a ton of laws to, like, the Sabbath, and you could only walk a certain amount. You know, I like to go all the way back to Eve, who, you know, when the serpent asked her what the rules were for the tree of knowledge of good and evil, she said, we're not supposed to eat it, and we're not even supposed to touch it. Mm. And if you look at what God said, just don't eat it.
And yeah.
So, you know, the human nature to add more just to keep to think that we're keeping ourselves safe and away from the things that we're not supposed to do.
Yeah. Didn't really work out.
No, it doesn't, because human nature takes over.
Right.
But Jesus kind of comes and kind of wants to do a reset of how we're supposed to treat one another and to remind us of what it's supposed to look like to be a follower of God, to care for the poor and the widowed and the orphaned, and to touch the untouchable, heal the sick. You know, much of Jesus' ministry is reaching out to what people in normal, I guess, areas of power would look down as the small people. And Jesus says, nope, those are my people.
Right.
Which is, you know, still today is a vastly different thing than, you know, what the world is like.
And we just finished a sermon series yesterday. I think a 4 or 5 week series called Extending the Table. Yesterday I preached on, 1 Corinthians 11, you know, World Communion Sunday, it was communion. And talking about Paul's instructions to the Corinthians, because what the Corinthians were doing, you know, they were bringing the divisions, the class distinctions of the world into the church community. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the wealthy people would kind of bring their own food and not share it. Right. And the poor in the Corinthian church were going hungry, and they were kind of segregating themselves based on kind of status and wealth. And basically, Paul's argument is, if you belong to Christ, all those divisions have been obliterated. Hmm. You know, we are not defined by the divisions of, you know, the world, the term Paul would use.
Right.
And so for Paul, and really both Paul and Jesus, this is where I think there's a lot of agreement on this point. In the kingdom, I mean, it's radical equality.
Right.
And with Jesus, he goes even a step further. It's not radical equality, as if, you know, we're bringing the lower up to the same level. It's a reversal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't say the last shall be tied. I mean, it's the last right. shall be first and the first shall be last. And
not so it's meet in the middle.
Yes. I mean, so, and I think that was, I don't think Jesus is describing like an economic plan.
Right.
I think he's just talking about like the way the world works and the kingdom of God is turned upside down.
Yes.
And Paul's instructions to his churches, it's kind of like, all right, it's an upside down kind of kingdom. How does that work out? And the way that works out is everybody's equally welcome to the table.
Yeah. Well, there's a great book, Manna and Mercy. I've used it for plenty of youth and even some adult Sunday school classes, and we kind of walk through. It's a great, I forget who the authors are, and we'll try to link it in our Facebook page. But it shows a great image of how the world likes to structure things. And so, like, if you think of Pharaoh, they had Pharaoh on the top and then the people underneath him and finally get down to the Hebrew slaves. So you got this, you know, natural triangle. And then when we get to the gospel, Jesus talks about a society where it's the opposite. It's like a funnel.
Right.
You know, the last are on top. They're the first. And the first are exactly last. And it's a great imagery of how it, you know, the society that Jesus envisions us as followers to set up looks drastically different than the one that we actually live in.
Right.
One other place I see something completely different, and this might lead to some interesting conversation, is the kind of the society that the church starts in Acts 2.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Chapter 2, verse 42, it says, the believers devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, to the community, to their shared meals, and to their prayers. A sense of awe came over everyone, and God performed many wonders and signs through the apostles, which is great. You kind of got this church feel. It says, all the believers were united and shared everything. They would sell pieces of property and possessions and distribute the proceeds to everyone who needed them. And every day they met together in the temple and ate in their homes. They shared food and gladness and simplicity. They praised God and demonstrated God's goodness to everyone. The Lord added daily to the community those who were being saved. So you get this image of kind of a community and almost an economy as well, set up in here in this second chapter of Acts. So there's been a debate, though, and so I'm just curious in your thoughts, Wes, of what kind of governmental system does that kind of depict?
Nothing more than communal sharing. I mean, that's not really. I think it's a misreading of that situation to think that that represents a system of kind of macroeconomics. Mm-hmm. That's more of a co-op.
Okay.
You know, kind of a situation where, you know, cause it, I mean, granted, Acts talks about thousands of people, but they're not, you know, it's not like they're establishing kind of some kind of governance. You know, it's kind of like the driving question is, how do we care for one another?
Hmm.
And so as we see in Acts, like that model really became a model for helping the poor, not necessarily a model for life together.
Mm-hmm.
Because in just a couple chapters, it's all going to fall apart.
Well, yeah.
The Ananias and Sapphira. So it becomes more of a concern, like not necessarily how do we structure our economic life together, but more how do we help widows and orphans?
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get to, you know, Paul writing his letter to the Corinthian church, you see that it's that Acts chapter 2 is kind of the kind of the giddy starting place. Like we're all like so excited and so happy, which is wonderful. It's great. But then when you, you know, you got a job to go back to, you have kids to feed, how's this going to work? I mean, granted, it's not a capitalist society like ours, obviously.
Right.
So, you know, and these people, this is not in terms of culture at large. This is not an individualistic society. It's very much, they depended on each other far more than we do.
Mm.
What we see in some of Paul's letters is the difficulties and kind of that transformed way of living together as community. And I think a question of sustainability is maybe not a fair question. Because the church in Corinth, you know, Paul wasn't telling them to establish their own kind of micro economy there.
Right.
It's basically like you're going to participate in the economy of where you are. How do you then use what you earn and what you have? How do you use those resources to help one another?
Mm-hmm.
The radical equality came not so much with who, it's not a sharing of money so that we have an equal amount of money. It's that our lives both matter equally. Like our lives are both equally important. You know, because in the Roman world, it was a situation, if you were wealthy or well-connected or had power, you know, it was basically a given that your life was more important than, you know, the slave.
Right.
And so the radical thing about the gospel is not that we're going to have the same amount of money or resources, is that our lives are of equal importance and of equal value in the eyes of God. And what I have and what the money I have doesn't make me more important.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the radical, and it doesn't give, like in the church, my money is not going to give me a greater level of access or entree than, you know, the homeless man. I would love if that's the way it was throughout church history.
Right.
You know, but you know, even in the smallest little country church, the person that, you know, has the most money and gives the biggest gift, they're going to get more often than not preferential treatment.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's just the way of the world. And Paul was, in 1 Corinthians, Paul is pretty adamant that that's not the way, it's definitely not the way it should be.
Right. Well, and from what I hear you saying, it's not necessarily by the pastor who might treat them differently, but it's by the,
right,
the church itself. It'll be like, oh,
we can't make, you know, Mr. Thomas upset because then we can't pay the bills.
Yeah, you can't make him mad. Or, you know, well, you know, it's like some, you know, churches where, okay, well, church council meets, and if Thomas is not on the church council, well, we better ask what Thomas thinks.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, naive young pastors, as we used to be, would say, well, we have the power to make decision right here.
Like, no, you don't.
No, you don't.
Right.
So it's, you know, actually what I'll do today is say, you know, ask Thomas to serve on church council.
That's right. Yeah.
So that way we can just put it out on the table.
All right. Get it there. We don't have to worry about the, we don't have to worry about the parking lot meetings. Let's just have the one meeting here and get everybody on the, around the table.
Or we're going to make a decision and, you know, you should have said yes when I asked you to be on church council. All
right.
So.
Well, the reason I brought up Acts 2 was because I remember going through Men in Mercy with a youth group, and a very smart high schooler kind of got to that spot, and she's like, wait a second. Does this mean that communist is supposed to, or socialism is supposed to be the way that we're supposed to be governed? And so, you know, that's always been in my head of this section when we talk about culture and society, you know, that this brings up a different way of thinking. And, you know, currently socialism is being thrown out every other word and in the news and for good and bad. So it's just interesting to kind of think about, you know, this aspect of the early church.
Most of the times we throw around those terms, most of the you know, I wouldn't be able to sit here and give you an adequate definition of what socialism is, like legitimately.
Yeah. I couldn't do that either.
Yeah, you know, what people are, you know, what I think, and, you know, just to be frank, what conservatives are calling socialism, I mean, it's not really socialism.
Right.
I mean, we're all capitalists here. And, at least in major, you know, the major political parties.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just because, you know, there's disagreement about, you know,
the size and scale of government, what government should offer, doesn't mean all of a sudden the Democratic Party's socialist. I'm getting ready to, I don't want to follow that bunny trail. But I will say this, like, to keep it kind of in the church, you know, one of the things I really believe about the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of Paul, it doesn't really get beyond the community level. Until you get to Revelation where it talks about God, you know, being on the throne.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Jesus and Paul are not trying to give advice for how to reform Rome.
Right.
So there's no, I don't think from scripture, I don't think you can make any argument from the New Testament about the kind of government or the kind of economic system we should employ in America. It's just, that's a whole different, that's like trying to say, you know, I need to fix my car. I'm going to reference the cookbook. You know, it doesn't address that. At most, it gets to guidance for how to structure and organize a church. Not that we really listen to that much anymore in any denomination anyway.
Mm.
What I find interesting is when you do get in the New Testament, Jesus is not talking about government. Revelation is talking about government.
Mm-hmm.
And Revelation is a deeply anti-imperial book.
Right.
And having taught Revelation a number of times, the past few times I've taught it, what has become more and more clear to me is that what Revelation really kind of, where the prophetic edge there is about economic injustice. And I'm telling you, like in teaching Bible study, teaching different people, kind of going through the book of Revelation with people, I found it a lot easier to kind of challenge democracy, like, or kind of, you know, Republican forms of government, whatever. But if I start challenging capitalism, that's where people get real antsy.
Now you're just stepping on all 10 toes.
Yeah. I mean, and which the first time it happened, it really kind of surprised me. I'm like, you know, I had, you know, my Bible study group had heard me talk about, the difficulty with having the American flag in the sanctuary.
Right.
Nobody batted an eye. But if I start, you know, challenging their assumptions about, you know, capitalism and you know, consumerism, people start getting real nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Just an interesting little aside there.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we might get some comments in our Facebook page about those things, which we can run down those rabbit holes later.
Also.
People really want to, but I mean, I think you're right. What happens in Revelation, going back to the year of Jubilee? Is this all kind of a working towards that reset and bringing back the actual life and kind of structure and community that God truly desires?
Right.
Found in the new heaven and the new earth. So, interesting stuff.
Yes.
Fun. Yes. And what a, you know, take us all the way back to Game of Thrones too. I think, you know, Game of Thrones doesn't go into a lot of the detail of kind of the culture that exists there. It just, you know, we're just welcomed into that world without much explanation.
Which I love. I love. Yes. Like one of the things. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say, and you see that in most, you know, kind of fantasy, whether it's sci-fi like The Hunger Games or, you know, more of fantasy like Lord of the Rings. It's just like, here's the world that exists. You know, universe building, I guess you would call it.
Yes. Now, what I do love about that, about what Game of Thrones, the show, does really well, is like there's never really any monologue. Like Tyrion doesn't have like this 10-minute monologue about the drawbacks of feudalism.
Right.
You know, so they like, I remember watching the first two or three episodes of the series and felt like I had to do a lot of work to catch up to what people were talking. I had to watch like the first episode twice. Mm. All right. Now what's Robert Baratheon talking about? What's the background here?
Right.
And so there's not a whole lot of hand holding in Game of Thrones.
No, like, which I appreciated because it made me curious. And to me, that's just some of the hooks. Like, wait a second. Well, where is this coming from? Or what's the story behind that?
Yeah. And I'll give you an example of another entertainment that I love where it really annoys me. you know, I'm a Star Wars nerd. That's kind of my first love.
Right.
And I'm a big fan of Revenge of the Sith. And if you were to ask my family who my favorite Star Wars character is, they'll tell you Obi-Wan. Mm-hmm. But there's a line that makes me cringe every time when he's kind of having his face off with Anakin there when they first start yelling at each other. And Obi-Wan says, my commitment is to democracy. And I'm like, that's just like, I remember watching that first time. You had this heated pitch, like he's going to become Darth Vader. And all of a sudden, Obi-Wan's like, my commitment is to democracy. I'm like, that just totally sucked me out of the movie. you know, and every time I watch it, there's like, it just kind of it and Ewan McGregor does his best to sell that line.
Right.
It just feels kind of silly and out of place. And that happens really, really rarely in Game of Thrones.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very much a consistent kind of vision in that show, which I really appreciate. That there's no, you know, my commitment is to democracy speeches.
Right. Kind of a wink to the camera.
Yeah.
And then back to the world at hand.
Yeah, it's almost like if they had named a planet Iraqi. You know, talking about the evils of invading. You know, right. It's on that level. And
that'll be in Spaceballs too.
Yeah. The quest for more money.
So, well, I appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, man, it was good. It was, like I was kind of wondering it, like as I was thinking about it today, like, you know, That's a might be a tough topic, but you know, we're preachers. We like to talk.
Yeah, well, and I think the more I got into it, and I know there's a huge back story and, you know, a lot of history on this world that Martin has created, but you know, it's kind of fascinating to look at. Like, you know, here's where the what do they call it? The first men came over the bridge to Westeros, and that's how life started over there, and just how much thought he put into all this is just amazing.
And me and you, you know, we're ministers and we have two kids. We ain't got time to research all that stuff.
No, there's some very smart people on the internet who made some very good articles and videos that help us with that.
Yes. And some of them, I imagine some of them as we go through the season, some of them will post on Facebook.
Yes. I think that'd be a great thing of, you know, here's a great piece on the start of this, I guess, life in this fantasy world. So, and yeah, I think it'd be great.
They do have that YouTube series that kind of like details the kind of the background there. I think each season had like an hour long look at kind of the history of Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
So those are worth checking out too.
Yeah, some very deep dives.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, next week we're getting into religion, which will be, I think this will be a fun one. Talking about religion and spirituality in the Game of Thrones.
So, awesome.
Until next time.
We appreciate you all listening to this episode, and we want to continue the conversation with you. Do you agree with what was said, or do you have any questions? Join us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/theologyof and continue the conversation there. You can also email us at theologyofpodcast@gmail.com. If you don't mind, please leave us a rating and a review on whatever platform you're listening to us on. And if you enjoyed this episode, share it with some friends or post it on your social media page. That'll help us get the word out about what we are doing in here and how much you are enjoying it. We'd like to thank again the composer of our theme music this season, Dustin Shelton. I am Jim Parsons. On behalf of Wes Smith, we'd just like to thank you once again for listening to The Theology Of.